History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The period of 1940 to 1941 was a bleak time in American history for a lot of reasons. The country was still in the middle of a recession within the Great Depression. Resources were limited. And with World War II happening, the German army was rolling out their blitzkrieg and showing off their strike capability to the world that had begun to overtake Europe. Well, America knew that the war was coming and also knew that it was in very bad shape because it was using leftover resources from World War I. In order to fight on equal ground, the army realized they had to develop a vehicle for mobile warfare. They needed to replace the mule as a key transport for troops and weaponry across rough terrain. And something that I've discussed in episodes on World War I is that camels and other pack animals were widely used. Armies still relied on them, and America, for the first time, needed a dependable all-terrain vehicle in order to win World War II. So in 1940, three companies competed to develop America's first all-terrain, quarter-ton, 4x4 vehicle, the Jeep. What the Jeep did is it wasn't just a dependable vehicle in the background. It was one of the key things that helped the Allies emerge victorious in World War II. Today's guest is Paul Bruno. He's author of the new book, The Original Jeeps. And he discusses the story of the challenges and emotions and strategy and competition to design a Jeep, build it, and prototype it in only about 2 months after car companies got their specs from the military. There were three competing companies, American Bantam Car Company, Willis Overland Mortars, and Ford Motor Company, who are all pursuing the same sole-source government contract to build the Jeep. So what's truly amazing is that the three firms produced prototype models, each overcoming challenges and circumstances to do so. And if you know anything about manufacturing, being able to produce something in just a couple of months as a prototype and then scale up to build almost a million of these is absolutely amazing when it takes about 5 years to modify a windshield wiper in modern day vehicles. This is how important Jeeps were. General George Marshall called the Jeep America's greatest contribution to modern warfare. President and General Dwight Eisenhower said the Jeep was a key tool that helped win the war. There's almost a before Jeep and after Jeep time period because for all of human history, animals were required to be able to carry materials and food and other things. After the Jeep, warfare becomes completely mechanized. So very important aspect of warfare that most people overlook. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Paul Bruno. Paul, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, this is an interesting topic about Jeeps, and I love topics like this because you can explore angles of history that you don't normally do. And a Jeep is, in some ways, living history because it shares much more of its DNA, the modern Jeep, with the original Jeep, compared to a 2020 Chevy Malibu with a 1950s Chevy Bel Air. It's sort of like a shark, where it evolved to perfection millions of years ago, and it hasn't really changed because it does what it needs to do and hasn't changed much. But how much of that is true? Does the modern-day Jeep, is it really similar to the original Jeep that was designed up in the run-up to World War II?
I actually believe that. When I see Jeeps on the road today, I really feel like their DNA is just encoded in the original Jeeps that were built, the first three, which we cover in the book that we're going to discuss. And so I think the basic spirit and the basic engineering is the same, and even up through now, through 80 years. And that's why I think it's exciting when people go back and look in the detail we've been able to put into the book on just how these three came about and how literally I used the word miraculous it was. It just adds to the lore of the Jeep legend.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was reading about your book, it makes it sound like the Jeep is like a firearm, like an AK-47 that's been around forever because it performs a need. It performs, it has a purpose, and it does it very well, and it's very reliable, so you really don't need to change it. But let's go back to the time period when the Jeep is being designed. It sounds later on there are quotes by generals saying it was so important to the World War II effort. What? Why did a Jeep need to be built? Why were other automobiles at the time failing to do what a Jeep needed to do? And what about their design was lacking that necessitated the invention and design of the Jeep?
Excellent question. After World War One, then through the 20s and the 30s, obviously, especially German military capabilities really went to greater mobility. And in World War One, with the machine gun and 20th century technology, the Army realized that the mule for moving troops and small payloads wasn't going to work. When you get up to the late 1930s, what the Army had was the motorcycle with sidecar, but that had a lot of limitations in terms of cross-country ability and being able to mount weapons on it and, you know, carry payloads. So the other version, the other option was the half-ton truck, but the problem with that is it had a high silhouette, which made it an easy target. It also wasn't probably that good in terms of going across country. So they needed also a vehicle that could be utilized by all the different using arms, not just infantry, but field artillery, cavalry, ordnance, so on and so forth. So you needed this versatile vehicle that could do things the motorcycle and sidecar and the half-ton truck could not do, and they didn't have anything in their arsenal to do that. And so they were trying through the 30s to solve that issue. They did some testing in the infantry, which we detail in the book, in the late 30s, and they thought they had a solution, but that didn't work out. So when you get to late May 1940, a couple weeks after Hitler invaded the Low Countries in France, they literally had nothing on the drawing board to solve this problem.
All right, so you mentioned some of the requirements that this vehicle needs to have. It needs to be reliable, needs to have a low silhouette, it needs to be able to carry troops, all those things. So I imagine that when these requirements are being put out, people are coming up with all these solutions. Did you see any things that were put forward that failed, or just, okay, you want this, here's our proposal, and it's just totally terrible, kind of like a pre-Wright Brothers flyer that looks like a guy with bat wings that they're trying to accomplish this, but they're just way off, and you know, this is a terrible idea. Did you see anything like that?
In the testing in the late 1930s, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they were like, most of these things are not going to do anything we want. They did come up with the Mormon Harrington 4x4. Mm-hmm. And just as an ironic in Jeep history, the American Bantam Car Company, which built the very first Jeep, their vehicles were laughed off the field in the late 1930s. But what happened in 1940 was, through an exceptional set of circumstances, a gentleman in the infantry went to a meeting on transportation in late May and basically realized they had absolutely nothing. He goes back to his office after that meeting where there's absolutely nothing on the drawing board, and the representative for the American Bantam Car Company is sitting in the window in his office, and his name was Charles Payne, and he's looking for a gentleman by name of Robert Howie, who had created the Howie machine gun carrier. And this gentleman, whose name was Colonel Oseth, says to him, "He's not the guy. If you want the guy that knows everything that we need in infantry for vehicles, I'm your guy, and you need to talk to me." Over the next 2 weeks, they developed in the infantry office a general set of characteristics for the vehicle that they codified in a memo that was dated literally June 6, 1940, 4 years before D-Days. Hmm. So this is the first time I'll say in this interview, you can't make this stuff up. It's like unbelievable. So that's how the Jeep procurement started, is they came up with this general set of characteristics through basically a chance meeting between Charles Payne and Colonel Oseth. And Colonel Oseth really knew what infantry needed. And he put the characteristic that you mentioned, Scott, that we need a low silhouette. It has to, you know, be able to carry three people. It needs to do this and do that. And that's what kicked off the Jeep procurement. And we could go on from there, how the more detailed specs and the drawing came about. So when they built things, to answer your question, to the specs, they actually came pretty close, all three, to what they wanted. Not perfect, but not bad.
Well, let's talk about this. The three companies you're looking at to in the race to build a Jeep, there's the American Bantam Car Company, Ford, and then I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing this right. Willys Overland Motors, or how do you say it correctly?
That's a good one. I always called it Willys until someone corrected me and said call it Willis. So I call it Willis, but it's kind of almost interchangeable. But I will use Willis for the interview.
I'm going to get hate comments with car guys in the comment section for not pronouncing that correctly. So whatever. So what does it look like for them? When does the Army put forward its proposal? Okay, we need a vehicle designed to these specs. When do they start assembling together and putting plans together for designing their own vehicle to meet this?
Another great timeline question. So after the June 6th memo gets done, Oseth literally put a requirement in there because he was mad at the quartermaster. This is detailed in the book. So it would go to the ordnance division because he put armored face shielding in it. And basically, ordnance has no idea how to procure vehicles because that's what the quartermaster does. So they basically say, we have absolutely no idea what we're doing here. Let's go to Butler and talk to the small car experts in the country, Bantam. And that's what they do. So they go to Butler on June 19th and 20th, 1940. There's a very famous concept drawing in the book. And they really kind of start getting a feel for what they want, but they still don't have a really good idea. Then basically Army bureaucracy kicks in and someone gets involved and says, you know what? This isn't going to be an ordnance. This is going to be in the quartermaster. And so from late June, mid-June through early July, they work at Camp Holabird, Maryland, which was the Army's main vehicle depot for procuring vehicles at the time, to develop a specification which came out as ES-475, which we actually have in the appendix of the book, and a concept drawing, which I actually got the hold of my hand, the original concept drawing for a Jeep, 08370-Z. And that is what they were able to use to then go out to the manufacturers and say, here is what we want built. And the stories around how they came up with the specs are amazing. I'll just give you one. Bantam had an underpowered engine. So they did this mock-up and they put a Bantam engine in it and they tried to run it up a hill and it only got halfway up the hill. And Colonel Oseth, who I mentioned earlier, says, this is done. This isn't going to work. And Charles Payne was there, the American Bantam representative, and he comes running up and goes, oh, don't worry about that. We got a more powerful engine. We're gonna take care of that. So we're all good. And Colonel Olson says he kept the thing from being shipwrecked right there and that we would never even had a Jeep procurement. And that's just one of those stories. It's like, oh, yeah, don't worry about it. We got this covered. A thumbs up. We're good. Don't worry about it. So a lot of those types of stories in the early Jeep history lore.
All right, so what did it look like from, this is the stage from original design to prototyping. Did the other car companies have problems like this with their prototypes that they were showing off to the military?
Well, what happened was the military went out after they had the specification and the drawing and sent it to 135 companies because we have to send it to everybody. And only four showed up at the bid. And Crosley and Ford both said, we are not going to bid because the time frame that you want this in, 49 days, is impossible. Hmm. Willis basically put in a time and materials bid, and Bantam had put in a full proposal. And I actually got to hold their proposal in my hand, and their full proposal response to the Army's bid requirements is in the book. And basically what happened for the bid award is they came out and they said, well, Willis has the low bid. And the Bantam people like turned white. They're like, what? That's really how that happened. But they said, Willis says they can't build the pilot model in 49 days. They're taking 75 days. So with penalty, the bid is awarded to Bantam. Now, I will tell you, Bantam had no idea that they could build it in 49 days because Bantam was bankrupt. This is one of the great things of the story is Bantam builds the first Jeep prototype. They're completely bankrupt. They have no money, no staff, no engineering department. And that's one of the things that drew me to the story. I'm like, how did this happen? So when they built the first prototype, they built it to the specs. And that's how they were able to, you know, get the very first one is through that bid process. If I can tell you another one of those, are you kidding me stories? So Bantam gets the bid documents. They weren't expecting it. They don't have an engineering department. They call some guy up, named Carl Probst, who was an engineering designer in Detroit. He comes from Detroit, draws the concept drawing that they're going to build to in 18 hours. They put all the bid documentation together, and they go down on Sunday night, July 21st, 1940, and basically Charles Payne looks at the document, Scott, and says, this is, we haven't talked about yet, the weight requirement was an issue. Carl Probst had put in 1,800 pounds. The Army said it had to be 1,300 pounds. Everybody knew that it could not be done for 1,300 pounds. So Charles Payne says, we got to retype all these documents. They call up a stenographer. At 3:30 in the morning, they retype all the documents. And Carl Probst, in his recollection 20 years later, says, oh, we'll put in 1,273 pounds. 75 years later, I find their document in the archives, and I look at the weight box, and in that weight box, it said 1,273 pounds. And I'm saying to myself, I'm actually holding the actual document, or at least a copy of it, of what they retyped up at 3:30 in the morning, because Charles Payne said, this is a government this is a government procurement. If you don't have all the check boxes checked right, you will be rejected. And I'm just like, second time I said it, you can't make this up. It's like incredible.
So how did they do this? Because this is the opposite of how car makers work today. Well, maybe Tesla is different, but if you want a new windshield wiper, then you put it in order. The engineers spend 18 months designing one. Then they talk to their supplier. They work with that. They have 18 more months of back and forth. And the engineering mantra today of most traditional car companies is, let's model this out until we have absolutely no more reason not to do this. And then after 5 years, you have a new windshield wiper. But then that doesn't work with the current design. And then there's a huge factory recall. we don't really think of like the auto industry as fast moving for the most part. How do they do this in 48 days? Is everyone on amphetamines the whole time and they don't sleep? Are they just building from the ground up? Are they being super unconventional in how they do this? How do they make it work?
Well, great description of how they do it now. So how did Bantam do it?
Yeah.
They did it the exact opposite way. They had exceptionally talented people on their small build team, and they hand built it and they reverse engineered it. They would basically build the parts, order the parts, do what they needed to do. And then after they had the parts done and everything was being built, then they would do the drawings. They reverse engineered it. And basically that's a good observation. In the book, they actually talk about how they worked around the clock for the 49 days to get it done. I don't know if they were on amphetamines or not. They might have been on a lot of coffee at the time. You know, they were, you know, buying out Brazil yeah. and the coffee, but that's how they did it. And it's amazing. They were so talented. These people could, because what you were looking at is by 1940, kind of the end of the original era of automobile industry, and all these people, and you look at, and all their backgrounds are in the book because I found them in the archives. They were all hands-on, get your hands dirty people who could do that type of stuff. And most of the people that were working at Bantam and Willis and Ford had decades of experience building cars with their hands. So that's how they did it at 49 days. And oh, by the way, Scott, just in one of those, when did they finish it? Oh, they able to finish the vehicle 2 days before it was due, and they delivered it with a half an hour to spare on the 49th day, wow. At least for the Bantam vehicle.
And that's amazing. And like you said, the car industry was very different back then. And for car guys, I'm not a car guy myself, but I know enough about it to know that people who can spot a make and model just by seeing a little bit of a fender, they can do that up to around World War II. But when you get much further back than World War II, it becomes very hard, not because they don't have the knowledge, but there's not just the big three. There's not the big three in Packard or whatever. Then it's hundreds and hundreds of other companies like you described, because there's much more of like a scrappy upstart approach to building a car back then as opposed to the way it consolidates after the war. Is Bantam the only one that's really working furiously on this? Was anyone else really trying to get a prototype going?
Actually, Willis was really working hard to get another prototype. And going to your point about how the industry worked. We have some good history on Willis on exactly what you're talking about. It was so ad hoc in the early days, you know, starting around 1900, you know, in through the 1920s and 1930s of all these startups just trying to do things, you know, very similar to the technology industry, say in the 1970s and the 1980s in our time frame. But what happened with Willis was they were interested in building this vehicle. Willis was financially, in the 1930s, they also struggled. They were not as in desperate straits as Bantam. That is admittedly a low bar. So what happened with Willis was they went for that contract that we talked about, and they didn't get it.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
So long story short, the Army approached them and said, you know, if you guys want to build a prototype on your own money and at all the risk, and you can build one, we'll take a look at it because we are wonderful people here in the Army. And Willis really, yeah, they're wonderful people. We're, you know, you take all the risk and spend all the money, and I mean, we'll take a look at it. So Willis actually did that. And that was quite amazing. And their story is as amazing as Bantam's. It took them longer to get their prototype done, but they delivered it on November 13th, 1940. And that's detailed in chapter 9 and 10 of the book of Willis's journey to build their prototype or pilot model and deliver it to the Army. And they spent $35,000 of 1940 money. That was real money back then. That was like, wow, they were all in to try to get this contract.
Did they have a similar approach as Bantam, where they build it and then work backwards, or do they do it differently?
It was kind of a hybrid approach to Bantam. They used a small team, but because they were a bigger organization, they had some more structure in their build paradigm. But it was still pretty innovative, where they had to, you know, work out problems and work out kinks, you know, on the fly. And they were also another exceptionally talented group of people that could be able to do that. And so that's where I was talking about at the beginning of the interview, the DNA built into the Bantam prototype of these incredibly talented, hands-on automotive experts, and the same with the Willis pilot model, is incredible. So they used a little bit pretty similar, but not exactly the same.
And I'll get to Ford in a second, but something I'm curious about is they build a prototype, but obviously the Army doesn't want a prototype. They want something that can be mass manufactured because we're fighting a global war here. And as anyone who looks at car prototypes knows, car companies can have incredible concept cars or prototypes at auto shows, like ridiculous concept cars that are completely impractical, probably not street legal, but they never see the light of day. And one of the main reasons is building a prototype is one thing, with a bunch of engineers getting together and tinkering around and making something that can actually be mass manufactured is completely different. That's why cars at auto shows look awesome. But then after you get through death by committee and then safety standards and everything comes out the other end looking like a Toyota Camry. It's just like, that's all that's on the highway. So from going to concept to mass manufacturing, what are they thinking about this? I mean, were the vehicles that were prototyped able to jump from going to that into something that could be mass manufactured well, or did it have to be completely redesigned again?
Yes and no. And what do I mean by that? Like, that's a nice, you know, solid political answer there, Paul. What happened was, because they were building to the Army specification, ES-475 and the concept drawing I mentioned, they built three pilot models that had their own stamp on them, each manufacturer, Bantam, Willis, and Ford, but there was a lot of similarities. And when the Bantam's prototype came in and it was tested, it was amazingly universally accepted. So the answer to your question in the short version is, but, and this is documented in the book to some degree through early 1941 with the Willis MA, they tested all three pilot models. They had a lot of evolutionary changes through the testing. And then in the spring, by the time the spring came around, Bantam had this third iteration of their vehicle called the BRC-40. Ford had evolved their vehicle to what they called the GP. and Willys had evolved their vehicle to what they called the Willys MA. And by that time, in spring of 1941, the vehicles were really, really solid. Then they went into a competition to get the huge first contract in July of 1941. So being able to manufacture it on scale was almost built into all three pilot models because of the level of standardization they put in because they were following the Army specifications. And then through the evolutionary process I just mentioned, they had a really solid vehicle by the time they went into mass production in 1941. So it was pretty good. And how that came about is Willys got the first contract in July of 41 for 16,000. And then they wanted a whole bunch of more changes. So Willys renamed their MA the MB because it was such even more different than the MA. And that was the vehicle that was built for the war, the Willys MB. So that was pretty amazing how it evolved. One other point, if I can make it, is you just see in the documentation in 1940, they come out in the first contract in July of 1940 and says, you know what? We'll get 70 of these. They really had no idea of the magnitude of the war they were about to get into. And you see over the course of the year in their documentation that you see them start to realize we're going to need a lot more of these. And the first contract that they put in was for 16,000. So you go in July of 1941. So you go from a year from we're going to need 70, we're looking at least 16,000. Eventually, they built over 600,000 for the war. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, it sounds like now this episode is being recorded in late 2020 when a lot of pharmaceutical companies are trying to put together a coronavirus vaccine and they need to scale up from hundreds of millions and maybe even billions of doses since they're wanting to service a global population. And whatever the final number of Jeeps that were produced for the war, was it in the millions?
Actually, it was about 600,000, 360,000 approximately by Willys and 277,000 by Ford. If you want to hear the story of how Ford got into it, I can mention that briefly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in October 1941, the quartermaster had two smaller manufacturers. And I worked in government, and sometimes you tend to have a little bias toward government, toward larger manufacturers when you're in government because of the risk factor. They're not going to probably go out of business, and they're probably going to be there, and they had the production capacity. So in October of 40, the quartermaster brings Ford down and says, we'd like you to build a pilot model too. And Ford says, okay, we'll do that. So they had a lot of lessons learned from Willys and Bantam, and they were able to build their pilot model in about 6 weeks, and they delivered it in late November of 1940. Fast forward, Willys wins the first contract in July of 41. By November of 41, the Army says, you know, we're going to need even more of these than Willys can build. So they go to Willys and say, how would you like to share your vehicle, the Willys MB, you know, all the drawings, the concepts, all the engineering with Ford and have them build your vehicle under license? And Willys said, that sounds good to us. It's kind of one of those Godfather offers, you know, an offer you can't refuse.
Right.
So Ford built the Willys vehicle under license and they named it the GPW, General Purpose Willys. So that's how Ford was able to build 277,000 for the war using the license from Willys. But that just shows you how even the Soviet Union was invaded in July of 41. So by November, they started to realize the global nature and scale. And obviously, Japan was causing serious issues in the Pacific. I mean, they were causing that since I know you're kind of a World War II buff also. Manchuria in 1931. But by November 41, they started to realize we're going to be on two fronts. And we're going to need a lot of everything, including Jeeps.
All right. So as these start to roll off the line, when the United States enters the war and they start to use Jeeps, I was surprised at the quotes in the book of how much they're praised. George C. Marshall says the Jeep is America's greatest contribution to modern warfare. Very high praise. He's not talking about weapons. He's talking about transportation. So can you describe the change? Let's talk about AJ, BJ, after Jeep, before Jeep, these time periods, what kind of difference does it make when it becomes integrated into the war effort?
Well, I think we really described that well in the epilogue of the book. A friend of mine found this quote in a book called D-Day from the German Perspective. And one of the soldiers said, when we saw the Allies come on shore, all mechanized, no horses, no animals, and we, the Wehrmacht, even in 1944, were still using horses and still had veterinarians, we knew we were facing a massively modern opponent. And the key vehicle for transportation that provided the mobility was the Jeep. And the other side of it, before Jeep, after Jeep, was you had a vehicle that was so well designed by all three manufacturers and then came together as the Willis MB that it could fight on all theaters in a global war, from sub-zero temperatures to jungles. And that's why I think they gave it so much credit, is we would not have had the mobility on every front in all different terrain, all different types of conditions, without the absolute versatility of the Jeep. So between the German perspective of, wow, these guys are totally, you know, mechanized, and its versatility to fight anywhere, it was amazingly the advantage it gave Allied forces, and such the key concept or the key capability that needed it in warfare from pretty much World War II on, which was mobility.
And that's a good point, because as a counterexample of what it was like before then, even in very recent history, I'm wrapping up a series on World War I with a co-host, and pack animals were a huge part of World War I. Some people think of tanks as World War I, but those were still barely out of the prototype stage. They broke down all the time. There were millions of camels that were a part of World War I, especially in the Middle Eastern theater, because they were sturdy pack animals. So you can find all sorts of images of people using camels to haul guns, tanks, everything else you can imagine. So to go from that, which is in pretty recent history, up to World War II, when the Axis powers are still using horses, there's still cavalry charges, still some camels being used in different fronts of the war, to the Americans being, were they completely mechanized? Thanks to the, did the Jeep absolutely replace everything that horses would do?
I believe so. Absolutely.
Okay. Wow.
That was its purpose. Replace the mule, replace the horse, get rid of the animal portion of the army. And I, you know, I'm thinking about it. I had, you know, I don't think I ever really thought about it before, but when you look at photographs from World War II, from any theater, I don't think on the ally side or the Americans, you don't see animals there pretty much. You see Jeep. See vehicles. I'm thinking that. Just do the same thing with me. Just, I never thought of it that way. Are you with me on that one?
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because really that's a shift, a breaking point in human history in one sense, because animals have always been part of war. And to get an idea of how weird history is, there's a whole branch called animal studies. And some of the people in it are as weird as you would think that they would be, but others make an important case that animals, whether pack animals or using for food, whatever, have been part of human society since the domestication of animals, the beginning of civilization. They've been part of war forever. And yeah, after World War II, when they're not a part of it, it's bizarre. Just because they've always been there, they've always been used to ferry equipment. Well, I want to get into the significance of the Jeep, but before that, is there anything else you want to mention in the run-up to the war and this miraculously fast prototyping and manufacturing of all these? Is there anything else you wanted to mention with that?
The only thing I would mention is, you know, just how unprepared the Allies were toward late 1930 because of the Depression. We go through that, you know, the Army between World War I and World War II. And in 1920s, there was this great peace movement, and there wasn't any powers really threatening the world. So everybody's like, oh, we're going to have this great peace. We're going to have peace. We fought the war to end all wars, to quote Mr. Wilson, so on and so forth. Then in the 1930s, you had the Depression. You had the rise of obviously Germany and Japan and probably Italy. And but between 1930 and 1938 or so, there was no money. And so they didn't really modernize. In fact, they were telling, you know, the Army, you know, you really need to use up all the surplus from World War I. Now, this is almost 20 years after World War I. Well, there's two huge problems with that. Number one, the stuff is old, which means it's going to need a lot of maintenance. And number two, military hardware, for the most part, becomes obsolete very quickly. And the Army's like, what do we do with the exceptionally small resources that we have? And one of the things they did was they did look into vehicles. By 38, 39, they started to free up some money. But as one person said, and we quote in a book, it took at that time, and it may still be true, it takes like 2 years to turn money into actual fighting capability. And so they had a real problem of how far behind they really were in 1940 on the curve because of those two particular dynamics, the peace decade of the 20s and then the depression decade of the 30s. So it really lays a background for like, wow, what happened in 1940.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Well, the history is littered with examples of weapons concepts or transportation concepts that people come up with that are great in theory, but don't work in practice. Either they break easily, they don't perform any kind of useful function. I don't know, Zeppelins being used, for example, in war. Great idea, it doesn't work in practice. Even the V2 rockets that Germany designed, they seem terrifying, but they required so many resources to use and they were so inaccurate that they didn't have a huge effect on the war. Did work for our Apollo program, so thank you, Germany, for that, but not really helping you win, which is good. But the Jeep actually does it. It does what it was designed to do. It works fantastically well. So what do you think are some of the lessons of the Jeep, whether from a project management perspective, a manufacturing perspective, anything, any one of those things?
And before I answer that question, to go to your point about how well the Jeep worked, I was on another interview and the gentleman was in the Army in the early 80s and they were still using Jeeps. I mean, wow. Literally almost 40 years after the war ended, World War II, they were still using Jeeps. That is incredible because military vehicles become so obsolete so quickly, or military hardware or military or munitions, whatever it may be. And that just really struck me saying, how good was this vehicle that didn't replace it to the late 80s with the Humvee? Now to answer your question, I mean, the lessons of the Jeep procurement, early Jeep history is, you know, one, I think, is never underestimate the ingenuity and innovation of the human mind and what people can do when they're pressed to the wall, where it's like, you're bankrupt, this is it. It's all or nothing for American Bantam. Willis, you need this or you're not going to survive. And what these people did to be able to make this happen, I think that's one of the lessons for today. You know, and you see that with the coronavirus vaccine, where they're kind of going back to some of that. And I don't know how practical it is because I'm not a vaccine expert by any stretch of the imagination, but they want to do it. You know, we want to do this in warp speed. We have to do this with innovation we've never done before. It usually takes years to come up with a vaccine. Now we're going to try to do it in, a year, say, for example. And back then in 1940, I mean, literally the odds were 5-1 in Detroit that Bantam could not build this thing in 49 days. And they did it. So, and you mentioned earlier in the interview, they just took the whole time frame that normally takes to develop a vehicle and blew it up. That, I think that's one of the lessons. And one of the lessons is you really need talented people and give them an impossible goal. Don't get in their way and let them have at it and see what happens. And that can also be used today for innovation. If I can mention one project management thing, but the way you're not supposed to do things.
Mm-hmm. Those are just as good lessons. Yes. In fact, much better lessons than what to do. So please.
I appreciate that. So this is one of my favorite stories in the procurement, in that how did they come up with the weight requirement, which was a bugaboo through the whole procurement in 1940, 1941. So the Army, without asking anyone that would have built the vehicle, that had any expertise in it, this is what you want, this is probably how much it's going to weigh. They said, well, you know, it's going to have, you know, we want something between the motorcycle and sidecar and the half-ton truck, which I mentioned earlier. Oh, so this thing's just going to magically weigh 1,300 pounds. And every single manufacturer said, there is no way what you're asking for that we can make this work 1,300 pounds. So basically, Bantam ignored the requirement, as I mentioned earlier. Willis, they struggled with their weight through the whole procurement, but they got to where they needed to be, and Ford was the same way. So that's one of the lessons for today is if you're coming up with requirements, and I worked in the information technology industry, and we'd get the same type of requirements, people would just say, I want this software to do this. It's like, it can't do that. And, oh, but it's going to do that. So be reasonable and talk to your experts and work collaboratively when you're coming up with requirements for something. So you hopefully have requirements that at worst are challenging. Challenging is okay. Impossible is probably not. And the weight at nothing that was delivered by any of the manufacturers on the three pilot models was anywhere near 1,300 pounds. So that's a good lesson learned for today.
Yeah, that's project management hell. And the little bit of IT contracting I did in the past, a manager who doesn't know anything about technology will have a request that's completely unfeasible, and they don't think it's anything to ask you to do it when they're basically asking you to build a new software from the ground up. And then you do a very, very simple task for them, and they think you're a wizard, and it took you 3 minutes. So it's just very good point there, what not to do. So, Paul, your book is The Original Jeeps. And if people want to see more about what you're up to online, other things you've written and learn more about this book and where to buy it, where is the best place to find you?
There's a number of places we could be found. The first is we have a Facebook page called The Original Jeeps. And on that page, what we're asking people to do is share their stories from family or friends in World War II. I'm sharing some of the stories of my uncle who flew as a flight engineer on B-24s out of Italy, and some fascinating stories there. So there's samples for people if they want to put their families or friends' stories out there from World War II. And I even have some stories from my aunt, who was my uncle, this particular uncle's wife. She was in the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps. And my cousin, Jean, she shared some stories with that. So that's one place to find us is at the Original Jeeps Facebook page. You can order the book. It's paperback only at Amazon.com. You can find it out there. Now, for people who watch a podcast or a video like you're putting together, I'm mentioning one other option, and that is for the same price as Amazon with shipping, you can order an autographed copy at dispatchermagazine.com/books. dispatchermagazine.com/books. So autograph copy there if someone wants that, same price as Amazon. Last place you can find us is we have a really excellent early Jeep history website called originaljeeps.com. And so go out to originaljeeps.com, check out all the early history out there. We have the concept drawing that from June 1940 out there, the original first drawing of a Jeep out there. And we have a contact form there. So if someone wants to contact me, that's a great way to get a hold of us and my team, you know, through originaljeeps.com.
All right. Sounds great. Well, appreciate you sharing all this. And Paul, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
There we go. That wraps up everything for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraser, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my spy masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Dalton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, where I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Dalton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get 3 hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Wonderful listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.